Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ben Shepherd is our guest this hour, joining us by phone from England, author of The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War. It is a fascinating story. 10 to 15 million displaced persons confronted the Allies in 1945, concentration camp victims. Rightfully so, made headlines, but the numbers, he says, were hugely augmented by millions of foreign workers and slave laborers, later joined by millions of destitute Germans who were expelled from former conquered nations. Institutions were created, first institutions actually, before the United Nations. They were established in 42 and 43, mostly by the British and the Americans and the Russians, when Allied planters were not fully aware of what was happening to the Jews in Europe, but were effectively monitoring the Germans' use of more than 10 million slave laborers in their economy. So this tells the story of what happened, how far the war's aftermath in 1945 corresponded to the one in which the Allies had planned for. Our guest author says there is also a modern parallel here, and we'll talk about those modern parallels. And there are many legacies of this time, and they are enormous. The State of Israel, the transformation of U.S. immigration policy, the ending of the homogenous Anglo-Saxon societies of Britain, Canada, and Australia, the creation of a new framework of international law under which individuals as well as nations have rights. All of these are legacies of this time. Joining us is Ben Shepherd. He's also the author of A War of Nerves and After Daybreak. He was producer of the UK television series The World at War and the Nuclear War. He's made many historical and scientific documentaries for the BBC and Channel 4. Lives in Bristol, England. He was born in England and grew up in South Africa. He writes regularly for the Times Literary Supplement and the Literary Review, has lectured widely at British universities, and held visiting fellowships at Yale and New York University. Ben Shepherd, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
This is just a fascinating story, which you do write in the intro, has not been examined very fully until now. Why is that?
It's mainly to do with the Cold War. It's mainly because while this story was going on with these displaced persons, communist power was being augmented, was being finally imposed in Eastern Europe, and that obviously dominated everything from that point onwards. And most of this material was not really didn't really come out again until after the end of the Cold War. There were one or two things written about it. But also, I think for the displaced persons themselves, this tended to be an interlude, a long interlude, a five-year interlude in their lives. And they tended to, you know, when they finally left Germany, they tended to get on with their lives elsewhere. And so they didn't look back at it until much later on. So that's, I think, the main reason why it has been neglected. But also, of course, you know, historians write books on particular subjects. The first, they write about the Second World War, and that ends in April 1945. They write about the Cold War, that effectively begins later. So this subject sort of sat in between these big historical, other big historical subjects, and tends to be rather neglected.
And yet they're so important for, in terms of policy for immigration and many other issues, for many years subsequent to 1945.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But also, you see, these things are very, what like me write about, but we're very dependent on what other people have written. We're very dependent on official histories and so on. And most of the people involved in this story, of course, are Ukrainian and Latvian and Lithuanian and Polish and so on. And then, of course, they're the Jews. And so there's a very slightly unbalanced kind of history, what we historians call historiography, which is to say a collection of writing to draw on. It's a bit better now than it was. But it's very sort of tilted in various ways, and that's another reason. So a lot has been written about Jewish survivors, obviously, for very good and proper reasons, but not very much has been written about these other people. So one of the things I was trying to do was to try and re-see this period as they saw it in the 1940s, rather than as we tend to see it today, without imposing too much hindsight. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, if you look at it from the perspective of the 1940s, then, for example, the concept of the Holocaust doesn't exist. The Holocaust is a concept, not as a fact, but as a concept, is a kind of later invention. The idea of the Holocaust as being something separate from the Second World War, which is very much the way we see it now. That is not how they saw it in the 1940s. And so that's one of the things I was trying to do, was to sort of get back to how these things were perceived in the 1940s, because only if you can do that can you understand the decisions that were taken.
You write, the institutions that were designed to help Europe recover after the war were established in 1942 and 1943 when Allied planners were not fully aware of what was happening to Europe's Jews, but were effectively monitoring the Germans' use of more than 10 million slave laborers in their economy. I just need to ask you, how can you not be aware of what was happening to Europe's Jews, but you were effectively monitoring the use of slave laborers?
Well, to answer that question, we'd have to have a conversation which would go on for about 4 days about who knew what, when, and so on. As I'm sure you know, at the end of, this is one of the mysteries of this story, actually, is that at the end of 1942, both London and Washington denounced what was happening in Eastern Europe, and in the British House of Commons, for example, stood in silence for a minute. And yet, people, armies in 1945 had no idea that they were going to turn up concentration camps at places like Belsen. It's a very complicated story, but essentially perception of what, knowledge of what was going on in Eastern Europe sort of came and went, and it was sort of it was overtaken in importance by various other things which were happening. But so far as my story is concerned, what I think happened was that the dominant mental construct was that of displacement. It was that of the displaced person. This was the phenomenon which they really saw happening in Eastern Europe. They saw these 10 million people, or whatever the number is, being displaced from Ukraine and Poland and so on, and being taken to Germany to work. And in a way, this phenomenon overlapped with and was intertwined with the phenomenon which we now call the Holocaust, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the Second World War, actually, the distinction between slave laborers on the one hand and what we would now call Holocaust survivors on the other, that distinction, by the beginning of 1945, that distinction had sort of broken down anyway, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a subject of enormous complexity, why they didn't. What they knew and the extent to which they applied that knowledge and the extent to which they did not apply that knowledge. And you can, if you want fully to answer that question, and it's not really what my book is about, but if you really want to answer that question, then you have to look in great detail also at the way in which Jewish organizations, both in the United States and in Great Britain and in Palestine, the Zionists in Palestine, the way they responded. And it's one of the curiosities, one of the tragedies of this, that David Ben-Gurion, for example, the Zionist leader about whom I write a great deal, he found it very, very difficult to comprehend what was happening in Eastern Europe. And even when he did know what was happening, he found it very difficult to do anything about it. So this problem of what they knew and I mean, I wrote a previous book about this. I wrote a previous book about Belsen, and in that I had to try and explain why it was that the British Army arrived at Bergen-Belsen in, May 1945, ignorant of the fact that there was this place called Bergen-Belsen. And that has a lot to do with the way armies operate in the field and their priorities. But it also has to do with the failure of Eisenhower's staff to properly brief the troops in the field. They did try and brief. They briefed them a bit, but they didn't brief them properly. So as far as this book is concerned, the big point, I think, is that, and I repeat what I said before, which is that the dominant construct, the really important thing which governed the institutions which they created and so on, was this idea that all over Europe people were being displaced and being made to go and work in Germany as slave laborers. And therefore, when they planned ahead, they said, when we enter Germany, there will be this problem of getting all these people back And there will be a problem also of not having a repetition of what happened after the First World War, when more people died after the war of disease and epidemics of one sort or another than were actually killed on the battlefield. So these were the two, I think, the two dominant themes in that planning.
And who were those planners? Who were the planners in Britain and in America and in Russia, for that matter?
Okay. Well, this, as I try and explain in the book, this problem fell throughout the war and afterwards. This question was split between the military on the one hand and this new institution, this new international institution, which was created in November 1943 by Roosevelt, called UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. And in theory, what was going to happen was that UNRWA would look after civilians. When the Allied armies occupied enemy territory, the military would deal with the immediate military problems, and UNRWA would deal with the aftermath. And this was the framework within which they planned in 43, 44. But what was happening simultaneously was that the military were gaining experience in Italy and in France, and were tending to operate, to do quite a lot of this themselves. When they went into Germany in 1945, there was a rather difficult relationship between the military and UNRWA, which eventually shook down by the end of the year. And eventually UNRWA was sort of, the problem of dealing with all these refugees was handed over to UNRWA. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. The material that you used in putting together the book, you found that getting information from refugees was the most difficult. They weren't the sort of people who wrote much down. But you were able to get some diaries which were invaluable to you.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this book is it's about two things. It's about a process, also about people. And I gave a talk at a literary festival in Britain last year, and I talked about the process. And afterwards, the guy who was chairing it said, he's a very nice man, he said, in effect, Ben's book isn't nearly as boring as he's made it sound. So then I rewrote the talk and talked entirely about people, right? So what I was trying to do in this book was to strike a balance. I mean, you have to have some of the institutional stuff, but it can be deadly boring writing about things like the United Nations or whatever, or reading about it. So I was trying to balance that with personal narratives of various kinds. And most of the people one's dealing with here are not very literate people. So the aid people, of course, were very literate, but the actual displaced persons, the actual refugees, were not, on the whole, very literate people. And it was quite difficult to kind of find their voice. And in the end, by digging and digging and digging, one found bits and pieces here and there. And as you know, I'm sure, as a historian, you try and get material which is of the time, because that is much cleaner and purer than later recollection. And I did have some successes. I, for example, found in a suitcase in North London, in Muswell Hill, an autobiography of a Polish woman who had worked for this organization, UNRWA, as a welfare worker. And she, in 1946, she'd got a bunch of displaced persons to write short autobiographical essays about their experiences and translated them into English. And there, in this unpublished manuscript, were all these people's accounts. So that was wonderful. And there's a huge archive in New York, in the United Nations archive of UNRWA. And in that, if you really dig, you can get a certain amount of stuff from the the guys themselves. Also, I mean, in recent years, a lot has been written, for example, in Canada by Ukrainian historians. So it's a sort of, one tries to sort of have an even sources, but as I said earlier, some of it is much richer than other bits.
Tell us a little bit more, and the book starts with some of the Polish slave labor, the German war machine dependency on foreign labor, and where they got this labor, and if different groups, the Polish were in one area, the Ukrainians, the Yugoslavs were in other areas, how did they divide the labor? How did they get the labor to come to their camps to work?
Well, one of the short autobiographical essays, which I just talked about that I found, was by this Polish woman. And she had been an art student in Krakow in Poland in 1939 when the Germans invaded. And she was working as a volunteer in the local hospital. And one day in 1940, I think it was about May of 1940, the Germans just turned up at this hospital and just took away the staff, the doctors and the nurses. They were all just taken away and put on a train and taken to Germany. And the patients were all sort of left, you know, with the needles hanging out or whatever. And she describes very well how they found themselves 2 days later in Hamm, I think it is, in Westphalia, in Germany, in a kind of hall with farmers sort of looking at them. It's like a sort of slave market, you know, as described in the antebellum United States. There they were, like apples and pears, and these farmers were saying, I'll have her, or she doesn't look very good, or whatever. And they were then, she was then taken off and made to work in the fields nearby, because the Germans, even at that stage of the war, were really short of agricultural labor. Well, later on, of course, they were short of all kinds of labor. One of the remarkable things I found was that Alain Robbe-Grillet, the French novelist, the avant-garde French novelist, you know, who wrote the film last year in Marienbad, he worked in Nuremberg making tanks. He was a Frenchman, of course. I think for a year in 1945. And so you have this all over Europe. And he was supervised by a Turk. So you have these people coming from all over Europe, and in particular from the Ukraine. And again, there's a French woman who was in the French resistance who was sent to work in a factory in Germany. And she describes these girls coming in from the Ukraine who were like, they were peasant girls. I mean, they were completely sort of innocent 17-year-old Ukrainians who'd never been introduced to modern cosmetics or let alone modern sanitation. And then 2 years later, these girls had all, she described brilliantly how 2 years later, these girls had all become the mistresses of Belgian slave workers. And so you have this sort of extraordinary process, which it's not comparable to the Holocaust, but it has never been sort of adequately recorded in the culture.
Right. And many of them became pregnant, didn't they?
And tended to leave the children. I mean, particularly the French girls tended to leave the children behind, which then became a big problem. What you did with them? No, the French Catholic hierarchy were very, very concerned about what they saw as a kind of complete breakdown of morality in these slave labor camps. How far that's exaggerated, I don't know, but certainly there is a sort of breakdown. And one of the themes that my book is about, actually, is about the attempt to restore morality and order in some of these communities after the war, the attempt to try and, for example, educate young girls, you know, into some sort of sense of greater dignity and self-respect. Because these circumstances they found themselves in have been so degrading.
I'm interested in those children. I know the book looks at this, too, and some of the decisions that had to be made by the agency as to whether or not they were going to be reunited with their families, whether or not they had a decision in staying with foster families where they were living. Two questions. Where did they go when their mothers had left them, and what happened to them after the war?
Well, this is a hugely complicated subject, but essentially what happened was that when these relief workers, these welfare workers with this organization UNRWA, went into Germany, they suddenly discovered that there were a lot of children around who didn't seem to be German. And then they got loads and loads of letters and things from people in Poland, mainly from Poland, Czechoslovakia, saying, please help us find our children. And then they discovered that what the Germans had been doing was kidnapping Polish and Czech children who seemed to be Aryan, and giving them to Germans. And so there was this whole process of the question of could you unscramble this? Could you find all these children and return them to their original parents, assuming their original parents were still alive? And this, of course, became very quickly subsumed into politics as the Cold War began to get going. And the question then became, should you put pressure on the Germans to reveal all these children, or should you just say, draw a line under it? And the military tended to take a rather practical view that it was too late to do anything about this, whereas the people who worked for UNRWA tended to argue that you should. You really ought to try and find all these children. And I can't remember the figures now, but, I mean, they didn't find an awful lot of... It was complicated, you see, because, mm-hmm. as I said, because some of these children had been kidnapped. Others were the illegitimate children of slave workers who had simply abandoned them in Germany when they went home. And distinguishing between these different groups and making some sort of decision with the resources that they had at the time, in the Germany of that period, which, you know, where everyone was starving and so on, it was very, very difficult. And you can imagine and I try and describe in the book, the kind of contentions which went on, the arguments within this bureaucratic structure about what should be done.
Ben Shepherd is our guest this hour. His book is The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The book looks at so much, but the major concentration is on UNRWA, which, as he says, represented a noble ideal for all its failings. And, of course, people in these organizations were looking at the world with lenses that we hope are somewhat different than the lenses we have now. But they had their own belief about national stereotypes, and we will talk about that. But they did feed enormous numbers of people, millions of people, refugees after the war, repatriated many more, helped countries of Eastern Europe recover from the most devastating war in history. So we'll be with your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Ben Shepherd, joining us by phone from England today. Hugh in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Hugh.
Hello. One of the things that you might mention is what happened to those who had formerly lived in the Ukraine or the old Soviet Union. Whether they be those who had fought with Vlasov or slave laborers. If I'm not mistaken, many of them were forcibly returned to Stalin's empire by the West, by the Americans, by the British, and they were killed, just automatically killed. You mentioned the German refugees after the war who were, you know, hated now in Poland and other countries. Many of them were killed before they got back to Germany. And in the German Autonomous Republic, the Volga Republic in the old Soviet Union, if I'm not mistaken, all of the men of that region had been exterminated by Stalin. Jews, some of whom got out of the camps and returned to the Polish homes, and you had pogroms, you had killing of the Jews in Poland after 1945. Also, Jews were sometimes put in charge of the Soviet concentration camps now to get rid of the anti-communists. I think I've mentioned enough things. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. I talk about quite a lot of this in the book. As you probably know, there was about 15 years ago, there was a tremendous amount of writing about the fact that people were forcibly returned. Ukrainians were forcibly returned. Yugoslavs were forcibly returned. Actually, this was quite a short period in 1945, and then it was stopped. And in the case of the Ukrainians, I can't remember the figures now, but vastly more people were not returned than were returned. Because if you came from the Western Ukraine, you were technically Polish, and therefore you couldn't be forcibly returned. And a lot of the people from the Eastern Ukraine pretended to be from Western Ukraine, pretended to be former Polish citizens. And this is one of the things which I write about at some length in the book. So far as the Germans, yes, again, this is not the primary theme of my book, but I do write about this, that there were, you have 13 million Germans expelled from Eastern Europe, and in the process of coming from Eastern Europe back into Germany, somewhere between 200,000 and 2 million of these Germans died. and nobody quite knows what the true figure is, and I don't think anyone will know what the true figure is.
How did they die?
Well, quite a lot were sort of beaten up and killed and assaulted, particularly in Czechoslovakia. A lot of them died simply from neglect and malnutrition in the course of the journey. I described this woman who was thrown out of Pomerania, and she had to leave at, I don't know, 45 minutes. This is now in East Prussia, now part of Poland. And she had to abandon, for an hour or something, this farmstead that her family had lived in for many years, for several generations. And she had to make her way to Berlin and then into what is now Western Germany. This was a terrible, terrible thing, and the Germans wrote about it themselves. They wrote down, they took down, the West German government took down in the 1950s everybody's testimony. So that stuff is very much on public record. And as we know, the German state, the new German state, West, the Federal Republic of West Germany, spent the next 10, 15 years coping with these people who were called Vertriebene, expellees from the East, and coping with the fact that they wouldn't recognize the new borders and so on. They wouldn't recognize the fact that large chunks of the old Germany had been given to Poland. And only comparatively late in the day, under Brandt, was this finally accepted. So, yes, I mean, that's an important part of what I'm writing about, but it's not my primary subject, because this was something they hadn't planned for at all. They didn't expect that to happen, the Allied planners.
Mm-hmm.
As to what happened in the Soviet Union, yes, the caller, Hugh, is absolutely right. I don't think all the Volga Germans were killed. I mean, they were basically expelled. They were moved to Siberia, if I remember rightly.
Who took care of paying for, and how was the enormous effort at feeding millions of people accomplished?
Well, who paid for it? The U.S. taxpayer paid for it. 72 cents in every dollar came from the United States for UNRWA, and ultimately it cost, I can't remember the figures now, I think it's about $3.2 billion, which is quite a lot of money in 1940s dollars. The United States paid for this, and one of the interesting aspects of this story is that this was more or less the only time that the United States engaged in multilateral aid, if that's the correct term. In other words, the United States gave a lot of money to an international organization which it did not itself control. It had the director of the organization, but it didn't have an automatic right of control or policy of the organization. And a lot of the money ended up going to Poland and to Ukraine and to Belarus, which were states which were either communist or becoming communist. So from the American point of view, this was a very souring experience, and American politicians concluded from this that they didn't want to go into this stuff again. And as you may know, nowadays the United States gives aid simply, it doesn't give aid through other organizations. It does it directly to Pakistan or to Israel, to its friends or people it needs to try and influence. But this was an episode of sort of internationalism, which Roosevelt initiated, and it was very short-lived.
Thank you, Hugh, for your call. Let's go to Bernie in Valdres. Hi, Bernie.
Hi. Very interesting topic. My family history is directly tied to this. My father is a survivor of the Ukrainian uprising in Volodymyr Zelensky. In Polish, you would say Wojciech. He lived in a small set of villages. One was called Shelets, and the other one was Markustov. Basically, we would call it Volyn County, in what's today Western Ukraine. It was obviously a county in Poland at that time. What the Germans did in that area was they took advantage of the Ukrainian nationalist movement, the UPA, the OUN, and had essentially allied themselves with that. The Ukrainians had actually formed a SS Panzer Division, the 14th Galicia,
yeah.
but which you can see videos of on YouTube. And the Ukrainians were basically set loose in that area in an ethnic cleansing campaign very similar to what Mladic is on trial for now. And the that was used as a way to stampede the Poles into Volodymyr. And the Germans, on the pretext of providing housing to the Poles, opened up rail cars and said, well, you can live in these rail cars.
Yeah.
And one night they came along and they slammed the doors shut and they were taken west. And the family wound up on a state-run farm near Hamburg. My father got into a little trouble being a teenager at the time on the farm, and he was thrown into Neuengamme concentration camp just outside of Hamburg.
Right.
I still have his... I have his Arbeitbuch for the work cruise that he was put on. They made him clean up and salvage after the bombings in Hamburg. He's also then a survivor of the Lubing disaster, where they took the survivors on trains and loaded them on ships, and then broadcasted in a broken code that it was actually SS troops escaping. And that was the last sortie of the British in World War II to sink the ships. Only my father was on the last train, and there wasn't any room for him.
Oh, my goodness. What a story.
That's an extraordinary story.
Yes. You would hope, as you as a historian were looking for material in the book, that this kind of record that Bernie has of his father would be kept somewhere, that historians would have access to that kind of story. Is there a place for that, Ben? Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yes, would there be a repository for stories like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number. I know mainly about, in this country, there's a place called the Imperial War Museum, which constantly takes testimony of various kinds. And everyone who has this kind of story, please write it down, you know, any sort of materials. The problem from a historian's point of view is one has to be selective always, and you have to try and take stories which will fit into the bigger picture.
Yes.
In my earlier book, which is about Bergen-Belsen, I did tell a number of these sorts of stories, and I got most of them from the archive in Yale, where there's a survivor archive, which, you know, has a lot of testimony, oral testimony, which is very good.
Mm-hmm. Bernie, thank you very much for your call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I would like to ask, many years ago, I went through the Holocaust Museum in Israel, and I was struck at that time, there is a difference between a concentration camp and a death camp. Obviously, even in this country during World War II, what we did to the Japanese were essentially herding them into concentration camps.
Mm.
And it seemed to me, and they have these maps laid out of Europe and all the countries and where all the concentration camps were and the death camps. And it struck me that the Germans, and I don't know, and this, I guess I first need to ask whether I'm misremembering this or if it was in fact the case, and if it was intentional. It seemed like, for example, Auschwitz in Poland, some of the other ones that were built specifically as death camps,
yeah,
all seemed to be, as far as I can recall, outside of German territorial borders.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Your distinction is absolutely right. And the other thing I should have said is that some of these camps, like Treblinka and Sobibor, had effectively done their work and been effaced. They'd been sort of removed. All trace had been removed by the end of 1944.
in some cases, by the end of 1943. So some of these death camps where horrifying numbers of people were murdered simply ceased to exist by the end of 1944. They'd just been removed. And, in fact, this is something which historians now study quite a lot, the way in which the Germans tried to just remove all trace of some of these camps. And in the case of, you know, the survivors, a handful of people actually lived to tell the tale, as it were. So, no, you're absolutely right. And one of the problems when the Allies went into Germany in 1945 is that they didn't understand this difference that you've been talking about. And they tended to talk about a concentration camp as a place where you locked up your enemies, which is what the Germans had been doing in the 1930s. They didn't fully understand that these had been sort of death factories. But, of course, the real death factories were liberated by the Russians, like Auschwitz, because, as you rightly say, they were tucked away in remote areas in Poland outside the German Reich.
Thank you, Scott, as always, for your call. Let's talk a little bit about the United States here. You talk about the humanitarian response to the refugee crisis was inevitably refracted through the lens of Capitol Hill. Congressmen made sure the legislation establishing UNRWA carried benefits for their own districts and those whose constituents were Polish Americans or of German extraction approached these questions in terms of their own electoral interests. Understandable. Politics plays a role everywhere, right?
Yeah, of course it does. No, I mean, on the one hand, the United States was extraordinarily generous in funding this organization, but Congress made sure that an awful lot of the funding went into the United States. It didn't leave the United States. In other words, it had to be spent on materials within the United States, which at the time was not necessarily the cheapest place to buy food and other such things, which UNRWA did buy. So there was a certain amount of subsidy of American industry and agriculture built into the whole process. So that's one part of what I'm saying. The other part is that inevitably you get congressmen who are representing Polish American districts or whatever who will voice the concerns of their constituents. And in many cases, at various times, these displaced persons camps which existed in Germany, we haven't said this, but there were displaced persons camps in Germany for 5 years between 1945 and 1950-ish. And there were, for most of that period, there was about 1 million people in these camps. And the army and the occupation authorities were quite keen to close them down. And one of the reasons they weren't able to close them down was that every time they tried to close them down, there would be an outcry from Polish Americans through their congressmen or from some other group. And your earlier caller was talking about the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians had very vocal supporters in Canada who also lobbied on their behalf. The other thing which happened, of course, is that, which I talk about in the book, is that by 1947-48, the question arose of were these people clearly not going to go back to Eastern Europe for various reasons. Either they didn't want to live under the communists or they were Jews and they didn't fancy going back to Poland for the reasons which your caller has mentioned. So the question arose of where were these people going to be resettled? And the State of Israel was created. A lot of the Jews went there. A lot of people went to the British Dominions, Canada, to Australia. The United States was quite slow to address this question, and it passed one act in 1948, another in 1950. And the process in on Congress was essentially a negotiation between interest groups on behalf of the Jews, on the one hand, who didn't have much congressional support, but who had a very, very effective lobbying operation. And on the other hand, you had congressmen from places like South Dakota or perhaps from Wisconsin, who represented German Americans or Poles. And essentially what happened was a deal was struck whereby the Americans agreed to let in, I can't remember the figure now, I think it's 100,000 Jews or so, in return for letting in a similar number of Germans, of Volksdeutsche, of Germans from the East. And which is why it was very ironic when somewhat later the Americans all turned around and said, my God, there are all these war criminals living amongst us. Right. Because in the 1940s, it was explicitly accepted that that's what you were doing, that you were letting into the country a lot of people who had been fighting on the German side and of course who could now be presented as victims of Stalin. They were seen by 1950. They'd become, you know, victims of communism. If you follow me through all this complexity.
Yes, no, I follow you. Was there a big debate about allowing those people to immigrate?
To come into the United States, yes, because American opinion was very strongly opposed initially, and then gradually it was softened up by this lobbying, very effective lobbying, which I've been describing. The other thing about in all this is that there comes to be a realization that these people might be a source of labor. I mean, that's why they were let into Canada and Australia. In those countries, they tried to just let in people who would be, you know, good young labor. In the United States, it was more complicated because people had to be sponsored. And so essentially, it was a process whereby various interest groups, such as the Catholic Church or the different Protestant churches, would sponsor people and would find new lives for them in the United States. So it's a much more fragmented process in the United States. And it's very difficult to find anyone who's typical. One has is sort of details. For example, the detail I like is these guys who were Jewish and who came in, and they said they were agricultural workers, and they were sent to Louisiana, and they were in New York City in about a month.
Right. Let's pause for a moment and we'll return. Our guest this hour is Ben Shepherd. He's the author of The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address, you can use that if you'd like, is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Rose in Blanchardville is next. Hi, Rose.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
About the children, there were, I was raised in an orphanage, and in 1946, I remember we being told that there was going to be a group of children that would be coming from Mexico that have traveled through from Poland, because I was raised in a Polish orphanage. And subsequently, I got to know one of the men who was one of the children, and he has pictures and a lot of information, and he belongs to what is called the Santa Rosa Club. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It was a group they stayed in this in Mexico. But they traveled. I think it was the children from elite families, because they traveled through Iraq and Iran and ended up in Russia. And a lot of the children died. And he has pictures, and he says, you know, this one died and this one died and that one died on the route. And finally, they were picked up by a U.S. Ship, and they stayed on this ship for about 3 months. And they ended up, they were let out at the in Mexico, and one of the nuns that was with this group came with these children to St. Hedwig, and I remember the night that they came in. Mm. A lot of these kids then were adopted out. Some of them were given to families to work. Some of the stories are not too good. Mm-hmm. What happened to them, you know. Some were okay, some were not too good. But this group still stayed together, just as, you know, I kept my the St. Hedwig Orphanage people together. The Santa Rosa group is also kept together.
Hmm. That's a fascinating story. This is something I don't write about in the book, but there were all these Poles who were taken to the Soviet Union, and then they were allowed out via what is now Iran. And a lot of them were in camps in the Middle East by 1944, run by UNRWA. And I guess this is part of the process these kids you're talking about would have been part of that process. And then they would have gone to Mexico after the war, I guess. Yeah, that's fascinating.
It is. Thank you, Rose, for your call. When you think about the mammoth effort that must have been required here, and not knowing exactly what you were going to find, it really is an extraordinary story, isn't it, Ben?
Yes, it is, and I think it's very heartwarming. I'm a hardened old cynic, you know, but I've I try and write about good people, and it's quite difficult because evil is much more interesting than much easier to write about than goodness, and particularly organized goodness, which is my subject here. But I believe in it, and I, you know, I find these stories incredibly moving, actually. Mm. And that's what I was trying to do in the book, is trying to convey. There's a quote in my book, almost the first thing, where this guy says, he's an English soldier, and he writes a letter in 1942, and he says, "What we need after the war is an enormous deal of kindness to atone for all the senseless hate and suffering of these years." And what I've been trying to do in this book is to explain how people tried to make that real, to make that concrete, to give it, to make it actually happen. And that is the most difficult thing to do, to actually translate good intentions into things on the ground. And I think to some extent they did succeed. They did translate good intentions into actual concrete benefits for human beings. And as such, I think it's a very heartwarming story. But, you know, along the way, a lot of mistakes were made.
But the world must have needed to see that, too, after they soon realized the extent of the horrors.
Yeah, I think in a way, it's a paradox, this, but I think in a way people were more innocent then. They were much more, they were better in some senses. They still had a capacity for optimism and for hope, which in a way we've kind of lost, I think we have since then. But maybe I'm influenced. I've been reading a book about modern humanitarian aid today, and that's full of terrible stories about what happened in Rwanda and so on. Mm-hmm. And maybe in the 1940s it was all a bit simpler. And certainly organizationally it was simpler because you just had this one big thing called UNRWA, which worked with, you know, the Quakers and the Red Cross and so on, but which did create a sort of coherent backbone of effort for all its mistakes, which, you know, made things possible.
I know that in part of the book, or somebody has interviewed you about this, if you'd like to expand on it, that there is a modern parallel here when you do postmortems of the debacle which followed the conquest of Iraq in 2003, Americans failing to prepare for the aftermath of war.
Well, yeah, we've had an inquiry. It's slightly gone out of the headlines here but for the last 2 or 3 years, we've had an inquiry rumbling on in this country about what happened in Iraq and why the decisions were taken. And the thing which comes out of that over and over and over and over again, everybody says this, is they didn't plan for the aftermath. And, you know, in particular, Rumsfeld seems to have made no plans for the aftermath. And then the contrast is routinely made with what happened in the 1940s, where they planned. Practically from 1940 onwards, people were planning for the aftermath because they knew, having been through the First World War and its aftermath, they knew that wars have aftermaths, and they knew that more people had died after the First World War of disease than had died on the battlefield. So they were determined that wasn't going to happen again. And so the early part of my book is about this process of how they were determined this wouldn't happen again, and they set up all these institutions and things. And that begs the question, if they did all this planning in the 1940s, did it work? Did they get what they planned for? And to some extent it did work, but to some extent they started planning too soon. This is what a lot of people felt later, that they would have been more flexible if they'd gone into this a bit later on, and if they'd been able to sort of organize institutions in 1945 rather than start in 1943. Because this organization I write about, UNRWA, spent an awful lot of money just existing before it, you know, got down to actually helping people. There's a huge bureaucracy in Washington and London and God knows where. So the lessons, this is the trouble with historians, that we don't draw simple lessons. That's why politicians never listen to historians, because they want simple lessons. But the lesson is a complex one. I mean, the overall lesson is that they made this wonderful effort to do something about it for good and bad reasons. And on the whole, it helped a lot of people. But at the same time, they got a lot of things wrong. And in some ways, the evidence from the 1940s suggests that you shouldn't plan too soon.
Mm. And I understand that you're now working on a narrative about four neuroscientists who operated between 1890 and 1940. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a kind of work of intellectual history about It's about four guys who in modern terms would be called neuroscientists or maybe psychologists, but they also did anthropology and various other things. But what they all did, these four guys, was they all became shell shock doctors in the First World War.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
That's something I've written about before, and uh-huh. I just wanted to go back and reapproach it from a slightly different angle, because I'm very interested in. I mean, I wrote this earlier book about military psychiatry, so I'm very interested in this whole question of what happens to the mind in wartime, and also the whole question of whether the efforts of psychiatrists to make people better in this field are helpful or unhelpful.
Oh, there's another show for us, which we'd love to do. Ben, thank you so much. We're plumb out of time.
Okay.
Thank you. Ben Shepherd, the book is The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War, a complex story, and he's quite a writer. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News coming up, we'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.